Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Morgan Hayes, Extension Specialist with the University of Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hello, Jay.
Seems like it's been a minute since we've done this, but we did one just last week, didn't we?
Or maybe a couple of weeks ago.
I think because we've traveled.
Time flies.
We're in Lexington.
The time has flown. It's hard to believe that Christmas is a week away.
Yeah, pretty quick.
I mean, that's
pretty quick. I guess this will air on Christmas Day.
Christmas Day. That's great.
Hey. Yeah.
We work around the calendar.
No days off, buddy. No days off.
Oh, man. That's part of it, though. And, that's the thing with education is you do want to keep things going. You don't want to miss here and there because there will be somebody on Christmas Day that after they've had enough to eat, after the grandkids have gone home, they need something else to do. And, what could be worse than sitting and listening to a podcast?
Yep.
It'll happen. I promise you.
Oh, it will.
It could be me.
That's true.
Yep.
Got a guest with us today, Ms. Morgan Hayes. How are you doing, ma'am?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great. Glad to have you here with us. You are an extension specialist with University of Kentucky, but talk a little bit about your area of expertise and what field you work in.
Sure. I'm an agricultural engineer, so by training I work on livestock facilities, all kinds of barns, ventilation, structures, facilities that we would build for animals.
Awesome.
So now, where are you from originally?
You don't hear my Kentucky accent coming through real clear today?
Well, it's...
Must be the microphone.
Yeah, I think it must be. Or my headphones. Maybe it's my headphones.
Yeah.
Originally from eastern Pennsylvania, degrees from Penn State here at Kentucky, and then Iowa State, and a little bit more time out in the Midwest before I came back here for my job.
Where specifically in eastern Pennsylvania?
Near Hatfield, Lansdale area. So if you're a livestock person, Hatfield is a big processor outside of Philadelphia, halfway between there and Allentown. So
I've traveled through Pennsylvania going other places. I think with the way the interstates are set up, that's what most people who've been to Pennsylvania do. They're going somewhere else, and they pass through. But beautiful state.
Yes, it is.
So before we just jump into the topic, we all kind of have our ag story of kind of how we got into agriculture. So just tell us a little bit about how you got into this field.
Yep, I'm a very typical person that wanted to work with animals and thought I'd be a vet.
Mm-hmm. Along with many others.
And then I worked at a vet's office, and that was an eye-opening experience. And I said, whoa, I do not have the temperament or the emotional quotient to be able to work with people with small animals. So I found my niche right there in that engineering and animal agriculture where those two meet. I'm in a family of engineers, and that's how I sort of ended up in that field. I now live on a farm. I do farm commercially with my husband, and I actually met him here at Kentucky in a beef production class. So pretty wild, but I do have a working knowledge of farming personally, and then I have a pretty good breadth of experience just from my former positions.
What county in Kentucky is your husband from?
Boyle County.
Boyle County, Danville. Gotcha.
Yep.
Good part of the world.
Yep.
You've got a short commute in every day.
Yeah, it's just an hour and change every day each way.
I like David.
Yeah, it's about an hour and change to my office from my house. So, yeah, I completely understand that.
It's just change to my office
from my
house. You beat me to it. That's exactly what I was going to say. So you've been with University of Kentucky in your current capacity for how long now?
Oh, 6 or 7 years, somewhere right around there.
Sounds good. I think David had you down for some farm visits here not too long ago. Yeah, that's kind of what kicked all this off.
Well, it is, and we also had a confinement. We're going to talk about confinement of beef cattle today, whether it be cow-calf or stocker calves or whatever, or finishing beef or whatever. I mean, it applies to a lot of areas. And we actually came down and discussed and looked at converting some other buildings into livestock buildings, and so there's a lot of different buildings that may be suited or may not be suited for for livestock feeding or confinement of any kind. But we actually had a confinement meeting last Thursday there at E-Town, and Dr. Hayes was there, and she, you know, she went through the different kinds of buildings and everything. And I guess kind of to get us cranked off, let's talk a little bit about the different kinds of buildings that that you can actually build.
Yeah, I think there's three primary styles of buildings that people use for animals. One is the traditional gabled barn. That's the one that has a triangle on the end wall and then two roof lines that are usually the same size. A gabled barn is a beautiful design. It's built by a lot of different people in the state. There's a lot of crews that can put them up. We have pretty good access to trusses in the state, so we can do some pretty good free spans on some gabled barns. And with a good sidewall opening, it is really receptive to wind from a lot of directions, which is nice because we are not known for having very consistent winds from one direction here in the state.
Well, the topography is so different as you move across the state, and that's going to have a big play in not necessarily wind direction, but wind speed or maybe the individual climates where they are, because they are, that is going to affect your wind direction somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. The big bodies of water play a big role. So areas that are, you know, along the Ohio River and stuff like that have very different wind dynamics than areas that are just, you know, sort of flatlands, or even as you get into eastern Kentucky into the mountains.
Right.
The wind moves through those areas a little bit differently, and local climates can be pretty variable. So the gabled barn is a forgiving structure. The next style that a lot of people look at, and one that's really touted heavily, is a monoslope. Monoslopes are used quite a bit in the upper Midwest. They are ideally suited for their climate. It gives them a lot of protection in the wintertime and good airflow in the summertime. And it is a beautiful barn, and, you know, with a lot of the newer metal trusses and things like that, they can make pretty big structures out of them. So a lot of people that are purchasing and doing backgrounding and things like that are influenced by those upper Midwest structures. So we see some pretty large monoslopes go in as well. The monoslope is a trickier design here in Kentucky. It takes a little bit more work on the siting and a little bit of consideration, but it's certainly a solid option for people. And the third style is a hoop barn. That's our fabric structures. Typically, they're a little bit narrower. They tend to be about 40-ish feet wide, sometimes up to about 50. Could even go down as narrow as 30-some feet. The beauty on the hoop barn is that we get really good visibility in them without having to light the barn up.
Right.
Since we're coming up on Christmas, we don't light it up like Christmas. We just let the sun do its thing. And we get good eye contact on all those animals. So a lot of people like those because, especially if they have all black cattle, it's really easy to identify the animal and how they're standing and be able to sometimes see disease and lameness. And like in a large group of black cattle, that can be really challenging in a barn. So that's one of the reasons people really enjoy that style. But there are a couple styles of hoop barns out there that we have to be kind of aware of if we're going with a hoop barn.
I guess that's one of the limitations when we talk about the traditional gable end barn. Some of those sheds built on the side, like a lot of them are, can get pretty dark. A lot of times they don't necessarily weren't originally built with windows along the side. That is going to hurt ventilation as well at some point. But the only light coming in or out is on either end of the building where a driveway door is. And I can see the benefits with hoop structures because of that.
Yep, that's exactly right. And the bigger the structure comes, the harder it is to get light to go into the center of
Absolutely. Yeah, look farther from end to end to get to the center.
Yep.
You know, when you mentioned talking about the monoslope barn, and, you know, we were talking about building one of these at one time, and so you and I discussed a bunch on email, and you know, we looked at doing that, but there's a little bit of a problem, and maybe we even need to back up a little bit further, Morgan, and talk about site selection. You know, wind speed and wind direction and all those things are very important if you're talking about building any of these barns, really. So maybe you want to back up maybe just a little bit and kind of talk about the site selection and what we need to have in that site to be able to be successful at this.
Yeah, so what we're really looking for, and the reason that I talk about ventilation so much, is when we talk about bringing animals into a barn, we're bringing these animals in. We have to have some sort of footing underfoot. Ideally, it's dry, right? The reason a lot of people look at barns is to get rid of mud issues that they're dealing with and get additional performance, either on the cows or on feeders. And when they go to do that, they really need the barn to be dry enough that the footing underfoot isn't like muck that they're pulling their feet in and out of and really working too hard at. So we want a barn that ventilates so we can get moisture out of that barn. And so a lot of times when we're doing siting, we're looking for barns to be on a ridge, on a high point on the farm. Not only does that give us better airflow, but it also means we don't have drainage bringing water into our barns. So we're always looking for those types of locations. Sometimes that's challenging. You know, there are areas of the state where we're like, how wide can we make it before we have to take the top of the hill off to get a flat spot? And it's not just Eastern Kentucky. It's a lot of areas of the state that we fight with that. But we're picking somewhere that's usually a higher point, and we're picking an area that we can level out reasonably effectively, cost effectively, which, you know, can be a challenge.
Yeah, and, you know, and I know where there is a couple of hoop barns that they built, and there was a big fad going around for several years. They'd help you build a barn, and you take these half dairy cross calves and feed them out and all this kind of stuff. But these two barns are built side by side pretty well down in a hole, and the ventilation is just terrible, and he can't get rid of the moisture.
Yep.
I mean, it's that bad. And so when he's feeding, and he feeds cattle out, and so when he gets ready to clean his barn out, his bed pack is like 3 or 4 feet deep.
Yep.
I mean, and it's just, you have to continually add straw to that to keep it halfway dry for those calves. And in performance, you know, you talk about, you know, calves pulling their feet out of the muck, and it all goes back to performance. You know, if you're feeding those cattle, you want them to gain as much as they can. Well, if they're having to work, expend a lot of energy over here in the bed pack trying to get around, that's going to hurt performance. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot to do with it, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and a challenge, too, is, I mean, where you're going to put this barn, and, I mean, you only own so much ground. Or you have a farm, or you might have a couple of farms or whatever, but you're not going to put a structure like that on a farm that you lease. And so just having to work around those challenges and the challenges that it hands you, and hopefully it'll work out. And there may be some instances where you just – Or I guess I should ask, are there instances where you look and there's just not a really suitable place? Or is there some things that you can do, even though you know you're not in an ideal situation, but when you start to build this, you're going to put in maybe some more fans or different things to try to help that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are spots that are bad, like just straight up bad, that you probably shouldn't invest in the infrastructure because it's going to cost so much in the long term to make it work, the operating costs, the extra bedding, the operation on the fans, things like that. But there are spots that are like acceptable but not perfect. Mm-hmm. And we can do things like doing a really good job of siting the barn so that we really pay attention to wind direction by month, make sure we're getting airflow through there, especially in the months of the year that are most critical. Ironically, you'd think that'd be the summer because of heat stress, but In fact, for us, it's a lot of times the winter because we have so much moisture we need to remove in the wintertime. And that air, as it gets colder, there's a lot less capacity for it to take moisture out of that barn. So we need a lot of air changes.
Just tend to sit there.
Right. Yeah, we tend to sit in this sort of not super humid, but high enough moisture in the air that we only have a small capacity for that air to pick up extra moisture before it's saturated. Mm-hmm. And so we really want to make sure that we're those winter winds, that they blow through the barn and they pick up that moisture and they help it exit the barn the way we need it to. And potentially that's things like we add a curtain so we don't get a lot of precipitation blowing into the barn. Mm-hmm. Or it could be something like we make our sidewalls 2 feet taller so we get more airflow through the barn.
Right.
And it might be that we have to use fans. Ideally, fans are a secondary option to allow us to maybe stock a little bit heavier than we were planning to, or if we're stocking in, instead of reducing our animal numbers, if we really need that animal number to make the potload, go through the barn efficiently, then we use fans to sort of offset if we've slightly undersized our barn.
Sure. So to make that decision of to go with fans or not to go with fans, is it an air movement speed that you look at? Is it a volume of the size of the building that you kind of figure how often will the air exchange take place? How do you make that decision?
Ideally, we're going to do our best to design the barn without fans. And then what's going to happen is we're going to say, our barn isn't quite performing the way we need it to, and our bedding costs are too high. Mm-hmm. Maybe if we used fans, we could offset some bedding cost. But it's a balancing act. This is like a scale. You got a teeter-totter here. You're either going to pay for electricity on those fans, or you're going to pay for bedding. But if you're at a spot where your bedding source, your bedding for that barn has disappeared, and you have to find another source, and now it's doubled in cost, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, maybe you put fans in to get less bedding. But ideally, we're going to set the barn up to be successful without fans in our initial design, and we might down the road have to use fans to balance that out.
How often do you come into an existing building situation, say a producer has acquired a farm, or maybe they're retooling? They're looking at the existing buildings that they have, and they're going to start feeding animals. You know, when you go into a situation like that and you're looking at an existing facility, what are some of the factors that you take in hand from the very start?
Oh, that's a great question. So retrofits are a big question because, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on the economics eventually, but they're expensive to build. And a lot of people, if they have an existing structure, they want to try and utilize it because it's essentially cheap square footage. Because when they buy a property, you don't typically pay on the square footage in barns in the same way that you would build.
It was factored into the land price from the beginning.
It was in the land price, and sometimes it has a value and sometimes it doesn't, but it's usually a nominal value. It's not the full cost to build a new structure when you purchase a barn. So people that have old dairies in the state, I think, have a pretty good opportunity to retrofit because dairies by nature had big, heavy animals that had lots of moisture, that had a manure management strategy associated with it, and a ventilation strategy too, because that was part of their design, and they had animals in there 24/7 in most of those barns. So they are actually in a pretty good situation to retrofit. We've looked at some poultry barns. Some poultry barns work. They definitely have mechanical ventilation assigned to them. They have to. They're not designed to ventilate naturally. So if we're going to use one as it stands, it almost has to account for that, and you have to run the electricity as part of that build design. I've seen people actually use truss structures from an old poultry barn and then retrofit that into a cattle barn. That's a good option in the sense that you have a cheap truss structure, but one thing to keep in mind is that a lot of times those trusses aren't designed for a partially open or an open structure. They're not designed to handle that wind and torquing. So you want to be really careful in how you do that because, you know, the engineering isn't there for that to work as an open-sided structure. Mm-hmm. But I see people do it. Needs a little bit more work to make that really a structurally sound design choice.
I think that's a key point because having a little bit of background in doing some building in the past, trusses have a load rating, both for their external load and then their internal load as well. And we see in a lot of older barns a lot of homemade trusses, and they might not have been rated for anything to hang underneath them, like fans, like curtains, anything like that. So key information for folks to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And trusses are also, they're rated both for their exterior load, their interior load, and they're rated to be both for an open-sided structure or for an enclosed structure.
Correct.
And the difference in loading for an open and an enclosed is actually that when the sides are open, you can get a lot of shifting and turning in that structure. So the load isn't actually pulling out on the truss. It's actually trying to torque the truss, like turn it. So one end's going towards the one end and the other end goes towards the other. And it creates a lot of weak points, especially on nail plates on those trusses. So worth noting that is not something you want to mess around with.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like something if you're retrofitting a barn or anything like that, you need to be thinking about that and have that information available. And of course, and I'll put a plug in for the Extension Service real quick here, but we have specialists and we have folks that can help you with that. And if you'll just come to your county extension office, folks, we can certainly get you taken care of. Morgan, touch on really quickly, and I know you don't have to be quickly, but just touch on the bedding situation and the different kinds of bedding that we can use in a barn like this, and what are the problems maybe with each of those and that kind of thing.
Okay, so in this state, there are three primary materials that we see people use for bedding. One is some sort of corn stubble, something that's coming out of a cornfield, a waste product. They're trying to get a little bit of organic off of the field just because they have so much volume there, and they didn't want to bush hog it another time. and that is a really nice structure in the sense that it tends to be available. Not free, but not super expensive. For people that have both a crop operation and a livestock operation, this is sometimes something that's on site already that they can reuse. It breaks down in the barn, and then they re-spread it onto their field. So they're actually cycling that nutrient internally on the farm, which is good.
Yep.
It's not the best, though, at absorbing moisture, and it will eventually, under foot traffic, break down. It'll hold up pretty well to animals walking on it, but after a while, you'll start to get a little bit of liquid leaching back out of it. So you need to keep adding on a pretty regular basis to keep that structure underfoot. Straw is by far the most absorbent option that we have out there. So if you throw a straw down into a wet barn, it sucks up that moisture really fast. It's really good at doing that. The challenge is it's the weakest one underfoot because it has the least cellulose, the least large carbon chains that really hold up under the weight of those big animals. And so it's really good for getting moisture managed, but it can be challenging to manage the straw itself. You end up with a lot of volume over time because you have to add all the time. In this state, we have a lot of straw that is high value because of the horse industry. So it tends to be fairly expensive compared to some of the other materials just because there's such a high demand for it for bedding in the horse industry here in central Kentucky. So that can be a challenge, but it's a nice substance. Again, it's one on a crop operation you might have on hand. You might be willing to just clean up bale with that, and then you're cycling your own nutrients, which is a good thing.
Yep.
And then the last one is like wood shavings, sawdust, things like that. That, because it's a woody substance, it's very good at holding moisture, and it doesn't break down very fast. So once that water is held by the wood, it doesn't tend to release back out.
Right.
So it tends to last a little longer between bedding applications. Volume-wise, in terms of the barn, it tends to be the least buildup over time, which is nice as well. It's usually something that's being brought in. We don't want to use anything that's green in terms of that material. We need something that's dried, which is hard to find, which means you're usually paying a pretty heavy penny to bring it, not only for the material, but also to ship it into the farm.
Yep.
And so it can be a challenging one unless you have a local source for it.
Now, those folks that use wood shavings or wood wood products, you know, we've talked about, or we've seen, you know, that people go in there and stir that every day with some kind of field cultivator or chisel plow or something, you know, kind of stir that up where that lasts longer. Obviously, those you don't do that on those other two products, but the wood, is that correct? I mean, I guess I'm asking.
Some people will be able to use a mixture of wood with a secondary material that's coming off of the farm, like a corn stover. But typically you need the wood in there to hold the structure to allow air pockets to stay in that material. The other two tend to get too compacted to use alone as part of a composting system. that's not to say that you couldn't, you know, you could use maybe some corn cobs. That tends to be a pretty good structure if there's a lot of cobs in there. Sometimes those will break down and hold up some structure too. But in general, you need some wood if you're going to do what's known as a compost bedded pack. In the dairy industry, they have been very clear and they've been very consistent that we need to do a compost bedded pack and turn it twice a day. It does two things. One, it gets oxygen in there twice a day. It keeps enough oxygen to keep the right bacteria populations working to break down that material. The really nice thing about a compost bedded pack is those bacteria, those bugs, as they work in that bedded pack, they push moisture out. Right. That heat pushes that moisture out of there, and we can really reduce the cost of bedding with a compost bedded pack. That's the key to that structure, is that the bedding cost is the hidden cost in this whole barn that people underestimate.
And when you talk about heat, that heat actually comes from the biological activity that's taking place in the compost.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, the surface isn't that much warmer than the outside air, but if you go down just an inch or 2 inches, we'll be sitting at a much warmer temperature. So we have a nice little insulation layer there. The underneath part is really heating up good and pushing moisture out. The top is not so hot as to be uncomfortable for the animals, but it's warm enough that it's encouraging the evaporation of moisture.
And on the bedding, I know it's going to depend upon whether you've got a cow-calf situation, whether it's stockers, but talk to us a little bit about how much bedding do you need per head?
That's a great question. So the numbers have been a little bit variable. We just, you know, when we were doing our calculations for the workshop last week, you know, we talked about a bedding number of, say, 10 to 15 pounds a lot of times for per animal per day. Mm-hmm. That's not an insignificant amount of bedding we're talking. That's a lot of bedding. It's hard to visualize what that actually means. Like if you're just doing it like this and you're trying to think about it in your head, but you know, that means we're talking about bales per year of bedding per animal.
Yeah.
You know, possibly into the double digits pretty comfortably. If we compost it, we might come down in that 7 or 8 bales per head per year for a cow. But if we're not composting, that number pretty quickly doubles or goes a little bit higher than that even. So it can be a pretty significant part of your design of the barn, not only in terms of having enough sidewall height to hold that bedding, but also in terms of a cost that you have to just handle during the year.
Yeah, we took a tour when our national meeting was in Iowa. And we actually got to visit some barns, some monoslopes, and some deep pit barns, and and then kind of we went to this private guy that probably fed out 200 or 300 head at a time, and he was actually bedding with corn stalks, but he was cleaning his out about every 30 days. He was cleaning his out, and I know the thing that kind of got to me was that he said, I just don't have the labor to be able to go in there and turn that every day.
Yep.
You know, because that is a consideration when you're talking about composting. You know, if you've got to be in there and turn it every day, and sometimes twice a day, whatever the protocol is, that's a labor factor that you've got to figure in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, if we can shift gears just a second, we've talked about the planning that goes into these facilities, the type of facility you want. We've talked about the different inputs as far as bedding goes, in bedding these barns and how to manage it in place. Let's talk a little bit about when we clean these barns out, about a management strategy that a producer might need to deal with this compost as it comes out of the barn.
Yeah. Well, this material, bedding, composted or not, is a huge volume.
Right.
And a lot of people underestimate both the time it's going to take to clean out a barn and the size of equipment they want to use to clean out a barn.
And then what to do with it once you get it out. Yeah. I guess that's really what I was thinking from an environmental concern.
Sure.
How do we manage all of that product?
Yeah, well, this is a great question, because if we're really looking at a barn as a strategy for managing our animals, we got to put the manure where it needs to be so that we get the nutrients where we need them to be. Mm-hmm. There is a value in manure.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And it's a high value. It's a little less than it was last year, because last year it was a really high value on that manure.
When commercial fertilizers were a lot more expensive.
Sure, because everything we do is compared to a commercial fertilizer. We're putting on phosphorus and potassium, small amounts of nitrogen, and we're putting down organic matter. So we are improving our soils, our ability to handle drought. People that use these types of fertilizers see value. There's a reason that people buy poultry litter in Western Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they're like, man, it's so much easier to spread than commercial fertilizer. That is not why they're spreading it. They're spreading it because they want the value out of it. Mm-hmm. And you get the same type of value, but less nutrient density when we come out of a cattle barn. So we're still going to get P and K. We're going to get a little bit of nitrogen, but we're going to get the organic matter. And we're going to get lots of organic matter because We had to use a lot of bedding to absorb all that moisture. And that's just the difference in the digestive tract of a bird versus a ruminant, right?
Right.
A lot more water in the system on a ruminant than a bird. That's why we have to offset with lots more organic matter. Both of them have real value, but we need to have a nutrient management plan. We need to do soil testing on our crop fields, and we need to apply to the soil test. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully we aren't in a spot where we're phosphorus limited, because if we can apply to the phosphorus demand or even put 2 years of P and K down at a time, it's much more efficient from a money standpoint for us to do that and then change fields every year. And that way we don't have all those trips back and forth. If we are coming off of an older livestock operation like a dairy, you know, we probably don't want to put it on the closest field to the barn, because that's the field that's been consistently applied on.
And we'll get loaded up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably pretty well loaded. But if we can put it on those fields that have a high-value crop, whether that's a grain crop, a hay crop, it could be anything that we have, that's where we want to use that to get our real advantage out of it. I think people dismiss that value. But, you know, the argument on confinement barns for pigs in the Midwest and for poultry, putting it into a grain operation, is because there's a value and people are willing to work with the animals to get the value of the manure. And we have to take that same mindset if we're going to a barn situation, that we have a valuable product here that we're going to utilize.
You mentioned a key point there, and that was applying to meet a soil test. We have areas in the state that are a little bit of a challenge, actually, when it comes to phosphorus management, because we've got such high natural, whether it's natural or enhanced, phosphorus amounts in our soil. So being able to read that soil test and apply to that is going to keep us from being in one of those over-application situations.
Yeah, absolutely. The last thing we want to do is put down a valuable product like phosphorus or potassium and not utilize it.
Right.
In addition, we don't want it ending up in our waterways. And this is a surface application. This is not a spot where we're going to inject or subsurface apply these nutrients. They are going to go onto the surface, and a rainfall event could cause the erosion to remove some of those nutrients. Right. So we don't want to do something irresponsible with it.
Pea is relatively not mobile in the soil, but it's that water movement above the hand that actually moves it around. That's what we're working against.
Exactly.
Well, and doing something like this, if you're thinking about moving or looking into confinement barns, you have to do your homework ahead of time. You cannot decide today that I want to do this and think that you're going to start building this thing in 3 weeks.
Sure.
I mean, even if you could get the construction sites there, or the workers there. I mean, just like you were talking about the site selection and knowing the wind direction by the month, things like that. I mean, this could be something that you could really gather all your information for 6 months before you make the decision on whether this is going to work for you. And folks really need to take the time to do that. If you're going to put this money into this and want to be successful, it's just like anything else. You've got to do your homework, and you've got to keep good records. Mm-hmm. You have to know what you need to know. I know that kind of sounds silly, but you do. You have to know these things if you're going to be successful in going into this with all the possible information that you can about your farm, about your site, what you're going to do with the manure and all of that before you ever start building anything or retrofitting anything.
Well, I mean, just to piggyback off what Vicki's talking about, I mean, we're talking about, you know, don't discount the amount of time and the equipment it's going to take to clean that barn out. My producer that's got the barns, he said takes him 7 days to clean one barn out. And I mean, it's just the way the barn is made has a lot to do with it, about all the gates and the different things to get it cleaned out. So don't discount that and don't discount, you know, you need to have a ag water quality plan, you need to have a nutrient management plan, you've got to work with all these different organizations, or you are going to be the CAFO and all that business with FSA and the government and all that stuff. You need to have all of that taken care of before you ever sit down and actually start building this facility.
You know, you're speaking of FSA, and I'll throw in RCS in there as well. That might be the place to start. with gathering your information. A lot of times, especially in the state of Kentucky, there may be programs that a producer may can take part in that might help offset the cost and the planning of some of these facilities.
You would hope so.
Yeah.
You'd hope so.
NRCS does a really nice job. They will be really good. They have pretty good information about sort of what you would expect the nutrients to look like out of a bedded pack barn. Right now, they aren't cost sharing on the barn itself, but they would cost share on a manure storage structure. And they certainly would help you with figuring out how to apply it, having a nutrient management plan. And, you know, all those things should be in place before the barn gets built. And it does take a while to get all of your ducks in a row to really be confident. And the people that are successful are the people that have really thought about it. You know, it's probably someone who's been waiting 2 years and they finally pull a trigger after they've really done their due diligence, that really enjoy the barn and are successful with the barn because they have the desire to do the work that the barn is going to take because they've already really looked enough at what that is to understand what they're getting into.
I think another thing to talk about too that we haven't touched on is herd health. When you start putting all of, you know, a lot of cattle in a confined facility, that really ups the ante, so to speak, on your herd health. And so I know you've probably worked with folks along those lines because all that kind of comes in together across those lines. But just talk about that for a little bit and some things to consider.
Yeah, so herd health is really important. This to me is probably one of those areas where people know that they might have issues with herd health because they're bringing a lot of animals in close confinement. And anyone, especially with a feeder operation that's picking up stuff from the stockyards, knows that once one animal is sick in that group, the whole animal herd, the whole group, the whole pot, they all are at risk. You bring them into a barn, they're much tighter on space. I mean, the likelihood that they're going to transfer disease is even greater. The one thing I will say is that the diseases you see in barns are not necessarily the same ones that you would see out on pasture. So, you know, we see things like cocci. We don't normally see cocci in cattle because they're out on pasture, but we see it in barns. We see some diseases that are more common in dairy that we will then start to pick up when we bring beef cattle into a barn. So we're constantly fighting some of this. And for people that have cow-calf, scouring is the biggest issue that they fight in a barn that they don't fight out on pasture because they just have enough space on pasture to not have that transfer of disease from one to the next. And so all of that comes into play. Key to doing this is to have that working relationship with the vet. Because you and the vet can have a plan. You can be doing, you know, a scour guard on your cows 2 weeks before calving, and you should be in a barn. You might not need to do that on pasture, but you move to a barn, that should be a priority for you, and you might have to run some sort of coccistat in your water. You might have to do some different things to manage health in a barn that you don't do on pasture, and that relationship with the vet is going to get you there, and that vet's going to be much better able to anticipate that, especially if they communicate or if they have other barns that they're managing.
Right.
Translating what both of you all just mentioned, I worked with a producer for years who had the ultimate barn design in his mind that he wanted. Every year I talked him out of building it. Every year. It was a constant battle. Eventually he got a barn built, but it was not near the structure that he wanted initially. And the whole thing was the only thing he was putting into his design aspect was how to meet all his needs. And he never once on those early days thought about what it was going to take to maintain this facility, what it was going to take to clean this facility out. The ventilation alone was a killer because the way he had originally designed what he wanted and the place where he wanted it, he was going to have a train wreck waiting for from the very start. It took several specialist visits, other specialists from UK coming in and saying the same thing over and over before he finally changed his mind on how and what he wanted. He's got a great facility now. It's serving his needs as a place to feed and feed in the dry. But he got away from that ultimate facility that he had in mind originally. And it's for all the reasons you all just said.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that we hadn't even talked about and for folks to consider is if they're going to have one of these barns, you need to have a place to be able to work cattle. mm-hmm. you know, whether that's inside the barn or it's right outside the barn or something, you know, when you're talking about designing a facility, you don't really think about that. But for folks that are considering, you know, please think about that. Morgan, something we hadn't touched on and we can touch on real quick, and I know you're not the economist, but we do need to talk some numbers and what you think or what can be successful, you know, cow-calf, you know, running a set of stockers or running three sets of stockers, you know, in a year's time. What do you think will work, just in your opinion? Not, it doesn't have to be anything, but just in your opinion, what kind of works for this state and what doesn't work?
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers are pretty compelling that feeders are a doable option. You want to be careful and sort of watch what you're spending money on, but don't cheap out to the point where the barn doesn't work anymore. That's not what you want to do. But feeders, I think, are a feasible option. But you're probably running three turns. You're probably running a lot of cattle through that barn. Most people that I see that are successful with feeders still bring them in on grass for the first 3 weeks before they go into a barn because they want to get a full group together. They want to get through that first run of disease if they're going to have something from coming through a stockyards before they go into a barn.
Yep.
Not because they're not going to all get it still on that pasture, but at least out on the pasture, they get a little bit more fresh air and they don't end up with the disease in the barn.
Right.
Once it's in the pen, it's very hard to knock it back out because there's moisture in that pen that allows that disease to continue to flourish there. So for the feeders, I think there's a lot of arguments that you can make that this will work. You still have to have land. You have to have the land base for all these cattle. All this manure has to go somewhere. So it can't stand alone. You have to have a plan for that as well. But I think there's a legitimate option there for feeders from a cost perspective to make it pay. The cow-calf is a much harder sell economically. It's just a very expensive thing to build for cows. That doesn't mean that the way we operate cows in the state are always economically correct either. I mean, there's a lot of people in this state that have cows because they like having cows, and they're willing to do things that, you know, with 10 head, they might not ever make money at it, and they're okay with that, and they might be okay with making it some sort of a barn and not making money on the barn.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not to say that if you're truly running this as a business, that for cow-calf, this is an easy sell. This is a much harder sell for cow-calf economically. I think the reality is you're not doing it with commercial cattle that you're selling at the stockyards.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If you are doing a barn for cow-calf, you have high-value animals. You're selling heifers and bulls. You're doing embryo transfer work. You're doing some high-value crops of calves, mm-hmm. where saving one or two calves a year really makes a major difference on your bottom line.
Right.
And you're a diligent manager doing this. This is not for someone who is not interested in checking cows and feeding them twice a day.
Yep.
Right.
You know, it's something we really haven't touched on much is the management. And much like poultry houses or swine confinement facilities, management is key.
Yeah.
I mean, it is key to this deal. It's not something you can just, I'm going to go feed them calves in the morning and I'm not going to go back to the next morning. That's probably not going to work too good.
No.
Cow-calf's the same way, you know, so management's going to be key on this entire deal. Anytime you put animals in confinement, a bunch of animals in the same place, you've got to be able to manage them much, much better than you would if they were just turned out on the pasture.
Yeah. On average, what size herds are you talking about? Let's just say on your stockers. I mean, and I know you can build it, I guess, as
big
as
you want to build.
Yeah, I was going to say, it can be as big as the barn is. But on average, the growers that you have worked with or that you have seen, you know, what size herd are we talking about? Or animals in the barn at a time?
Most people I see have barns that will hold, on the feeder side, at least two pots. So they have two pens, one for each pot load. So they're constantly churning through two turns. So they're, you know, every month and a half, they're turning a new group out. And then sometimes two to three is pretty common. I rarely see anyone go in with a barn for just one group, although occasionally I will see someone just want to turn one pot load through that barn. That's just not as common.
Even if they're doing two at a time, they're probably doing that seven, eight times a year?
Not always seven or eight, but at least three to four.
Okay.
It depends on how much time they have them on grass before they bring them into the barn.
Right.
Usually they're using that barn to push weight at the end of that growth cycle. So You know, they typically put on weight pretty well, wherever you feed them, however you feed them, from 400 pounds to 600 pounds. And from 600 to 800, they'll put on weight, but you have to be a little bit more diligent right. about getting feed in front of them. And so that 600 to 800 pound time frame is the one that they're really wanting to use the barn for. Anything lighter than 6 could go either way. It depends on the person. Some people like having lights in a barn just because they get protection from wind. Mm-hmm. But that's a little bit of a personal preference. The cow-calf people are looking at 30 head, 50 head, somewhere in that ballpark. Very rarely do I see anyone building for more than 50 head into a barn.
Mm-hmm. And most of those are because we talked about it at the confinement meeting, some of them stay 4 months and then turn back out on grass, and some stay year-round. I mean, yep. there's a lot of different options there. The one thing I want to caution folks about is if you put those cow-calves in there for say, 4 months while they're dry, and then you turn them out right before they calve, or you may do it vice versa. You may calve in the barn and then turn them out, but, you know, you need to be real careful if you're going to run a set of stocker calves through there, because you can pick up disease into your cow herd that you don't want to do that. If you're going to do stockers, just do stockers. If you're going to do cow-calves, just do cow-calf. Don't do both.
Yes. Amen.
Don't mingle.
That is a high risk. I've seen people run stockers and then a high value cow-calf operation, and the calves will come out and they'll lose 10 or 15%. Yeah. Anytime you lose that type of number of calves, you're in big trouble. Mm-hmm. And if you had a disease in that stocker group that was tough for you to get out of stockers, it's really tough to manage in weak-old calves. Yep. That is the last thing you want. Mm-hmm. The other thing I will say about cow-calf is you can run two groups of calving or three groups of calving. So I see people run their cows, their fall and spring cows, both through the barn and calve in there. And when they wean is when they turn out. So one of the things you can do with a barn is wean a little bit earlier at around 5 months. So bring them in, calve, and then roll the groups. So you can have two groups come through a barn. And that works as long as you have closed herds and you're managing your health. Right. That's not a bad option.
Yeah, my point was just to be real careful if you're thinking about doing stockers. Just do stockers or do cow-calf. Don't do both. And don't try to mingle those two in the same barn, because it'll be not good for anybody. Mm-hmm. So.
You know, one of the things we always do towards the end of a show is we have a timely tip that we try to give to our producers that puts into effect, you know, the topics that we've been talking about. And there's been a few things that I've picked up on, Morgan, that you've said a few times. So I think a good timely tip, or two tips today. One would be for the producers that are planning to do a barn like this, is to know your options. Do a lot of time. David mentioned earlier all the planning that should go into effect before you pull the trigger on building a facility like that. And the other is to have a good relationship with your veterinarian ahead of time. Getting into working inside a barn is going to bring about a whole new list of concerns for a producer that they might not have met, you know, doing everything in the field. So I think those make two good timely tips for today.
Absolutely.
So
I agree.
Well, we appreciate you being here with us today. I think this is a good show. It should be very well received. We've covered a lot of information today.
We have.
So special thanks to you for being here today, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.